is your pathway to, you went to the University of Geneva for medical
yes.
school.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how you got there?
Sure. I finished college at West Virginia State College, which is now West Virginia State University, in 1950. And I was a member of the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC, and this was during the Korean War, and I knew it was going to be, I was going to get drafted, so although I was pre-med, a biological science and German major, I knew I was going to get drafted, and so I even stayed an extra year to finish ROTC because I had transferred to West Virginia State College from another school, and so you had to be there 4 years to do ROTC. And so though I was pre-med, my degree was a Bachelor of Science in Education, I could only either go teaching or be a coach because I was a basketball player, or I could end up going to the service. And I knew I was going to get drafted even if I had taken one of those other jobs, so I took my commission and went into the 82nd Airborne Division and was a paratrooper officer for 4 years, and I got hurt in a car wreck. And I had
a friend. Where and when were you when you were hurt?
I was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, in the 82nd Airborne Division, which was a very light division of the service.
And yes.
As a matter of fact, I was the first black officer integrated to command white troops in our country. At the time I came out of the hospital from my injury, Truman had declared at that time that there would be, the officer corps would be integrated. And there had been integration in the services in Korea, where white officers commanded black troops. There was always white officers commanding black troops, but some black officers commanded black troops too, but no black officers commanded white troops. And so I was sent from my division, by division order, from the hospital to this white unit, completely white unit, as a young lieutenant that would have been a battery commander, but instead they made me a battalion intelligence officer. And then I got retired from the Army from a disability from my injury.
Yes.
Anyway, I had a friend who I had grown up with who was a All-American runner, as a matter of fact, at NYU. And he couldn't get into med school. He had applied, and instead of not giving up, instead of giving up and not going, he had some friends, a couple of Jewish kids who had also applied to medical school in Europe at the University of Geneva, and he went there, and he was graduating at the time I was coming out of the service from the University of Geneva Medical School, and we were inseparable growing up. And then
had you grown up?
I grew up in New York. Originally, I was from West Virginia. My family moved to New York when I was 12, and I, then grew up in New York. But he came to see me, at Fort Bragg, and as he got out of medical school, cause to celebrate. And I had been hurt, and I had gotten a medical, was in the process of getting a medical retirement. And so he said, well, why don't you make an application to medical school in Europe? I said, I better try here first. And I didn't speak French. And he said, well, you've had German, maybe you should apply to the German schools. I did. I applied to Heidelberg, Innsbruck in Austria, and I got in both schools. And so I got discharged from the service September the 30th, 1953. And October the 5th, I was sailing for Europe to go to med school at the University of Heidelberg.
Historians really like people who remember dates that specifically.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah.
So you first went to the University of Heidelberg.
Yes, and I couldn't get my GI Bill there, and I stayed there. They wouldn't allow the German schools for you to get your GI Bill to the German school. So I had only my retirement pay, which was about $80 a month, which was a lot of money too, because that was 400 marks in 1953. So I, as a matter of fact, I'll tell you the story. I was made passage. My family helped me, made passage on the Queen Mary. And the Queen Mary could not come into New York. All of a sudden, there was a tugboat strike in New York. And so in order to get the boat, I had to take a boat train from New York to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And the Queen Mary had to go there because, that was the closest port in the east where it could go into the harbor. And so the boat train was 2.5 days or something, 2 days I think it was, it took us to get up there. And I took the Queen Mary and went to Europe and got off, and it was a Cherbourg, I guess it was Cherbourg, and then took the boat train into the Gare Saint-Lazare. I never will forget it. And it was that September. Matter of fact, you know something? I had on a seersucker suit.
Like you do today.
Yeah, I had on a seersucker suit. And the real reason I remember it is because I had to go to the toilet when I got to the station in Paris, because I had bought some cognac on the way. One of the kids who was traveling on the boat with me, and it's an interesting story, he had gone to the toilet on the train, and he had a money belt, in those days his father had given him this money belt, and he had that, and somehow it got dislodged, and in those days the train, if you remember, you could stuff the defecation just went on the tracks, right?
I've traveled in Africa. It still does.
So is that right? Yeah. So his money belt came out and went on the tracks, and so he was panicking. So he didn't know what to do. But I had pulled pull the emergency thing. I thought that I could stop the whole damn train, this boat train. But I said, hey, instead of panicking, and let's pull this thing. So we did, and the train stopped, but it was too far back by the time, you just don't stop like that, where you are.
Yeah.
It's about a mile away. So, of course, he didn't find his wallet. But we got off at the station, and while we got off, I said, I wanted a drink, and I bought some cognac. So by the time I got to the station, the Gare Saint-Lazare in Paris, I had to go to the bathroom. And I was looking around I didn't know what the toilet was in French.
Yeah.
But there was, sort of outside of the Gare Saint-Lazare, there was where I had to get my trunk from the boat train to take it to put it on the other train to go from Paris to Heidelberg. Mm-hmm. There was a horse trough where the horses drank, because then too, horses were still pulling things. They weren't a whole lot. This was 53.
Yeah.
Okay. So there was a place that I saw. I asked somebody, and they said over there was a set WC horse closet. So I went there, and they just had this hole in the floor. Well, I had never, and these two things for your feet. So, I had to go so bad, and I had got diarrhea from drinking that cognac, okay? And I messed up my pants, right? And because I was in I had this brace on my leg from my injury, and I still had this brace on my leg, and I could not stoop down like you're supposed to. And so I really soiled myself. And so I was very meticulous guy, very much so, still like I am today. So I just came out of there, and I got some stuff on my shoes, and I jumped, got into, I just put in my suit, I just got into the horse where the water, the horse trough where they were the water, to wash myself off. And I just got out of there, and, you know, that's just sloshing in water. And I didn't care what anybody cared. I said, these people don't know me anyway.
Yeah.
And I went on and got my trunk, and then went on and got on the train and wet. Dried off, you know, normally, and went on the train and went to Heidelberg. Because you go, you know, you go through. See, how did I train? I forget the stops that it made, but anyway, we got into Germany, and I was had fallen asleep in my cabin, and the conductor came in and you know, asked me from that, and I still had, you know, my army raincoat on because it was cold, and this German with this, you know, had the German hat, and I mean, and he woke me up, and I was startled. I mean, as a matter of fact, all I could remember was the Second World War,
yes,
you know, and so forth. Because it was the uniform, and the train guy was still like, almost panicked. I mean, I almost started to fight him.
Yeah.
Because I woke me up, I was startled. So, anyway, got off and started Heidelberg. Stayed there a year, almost a year and a half. And I wanted, you know, I was married, and I couldn't get my GI Bill, which would have given me $160, and the $80 would have been $240, and I could have bring my wife over.
Mm-hmm. So you had been married before?
Yes, I got married in 1952. So instead of staying there, waiting to see whenever one could get the GI Bill or whatever, because I didn't, my wife was a teacher, I said, I want her over here, so I'd better find a way to get my GI Bill and get this $240, and then she could come and could have an apartment and everything else. So the only way you could do that was you could go to either an Italian school, a Swiss school, or a Dutch school. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what would be easier for me? You know, maybe I should try the Dutch school, maybe application over there. So I did. Made application to, you go through the Ministry of Education in Holland. You don't go to the med school like you do here. And then the Ministry of Education accepts you for medical studies. And if you accept it, they send you to one of the universities where there is a place available. So I made application. I went over there and got an interview. And with the Ministry of Education, and the guy who was the Deputy Minister of Education was from Nijmegen in Holland, and I had on this Army raincoat, and I had the 82nd Airborne All-American patch on, still there on my sleeve, and he took me for having been one of the paratroopers, because he saw I had to show my discharge, and he saw that, and he thought I was one of the paratroopers that had freed his town in Nijmegen, and he says, well, we're going to send you over to Nijmegen. He admitted me to school, and we're going to send me to Nijmegen, and I told him, no, there were no black paratroopers during the Second World War. The black paratroopers only started after the Second World War. We saw no combat, by the way, you know. But he didn't know that, and he said lots of your colleagues are buried there, and you would do fine there. Mm. Then I went over to Nijmegen, and they really didn't have a place. So he said, I came back and reported that. He says, well, we got a place for you at Utrecht. So I went to Utrecht, and I sit in the class there for a day, a couple of days, and I just, the Dutch was so difficult, even though with my German, I knew some German, but it was just so difficult, I just said, no, this ain't for me. I went back to Heidelberg and was, you know, very despondent, and you know, wanting to be with my wife and so forth, and so I said, let me try Switzerland, let me try the German part of Switzerland. So I went down to Basel, and I got and talked to the dean, and was going to get admitted to Basel or Zurich. And so I got there, and the Schweizer Deutsch was just as difficult as, you know, as the Dutch was. I said, what the hell am I doing here? So my friend said, you know, maybe Benny, I called on the phone, said, maybe try Geneva. He said, you'll do all right. You'll learn the language. It'll come easy for you. You know, you'll go to class every day, and you'll go to class, and you'll end up, and you'll speak to anybody, and you'll learn the language. So I went down to Geneva, and then there was my friend had two friends who were still there in school, black guys.
I was going to ask you if there were any other.
Yeah, there were two other black guys there, Chuck Wilson and Charles Peter Felton, as a matter of fact. They were juniors in the medical school. And so my friend said, go to Chuck, and he was a fraternity brother, too. He had in the black fraternity, college fraternities, Chuck was an alpha, and I had gone into alpha. And so we bonded that way. Mm-hmm. And he says, I'll take you to the dean. He says, no, better still, I'll take you to the registrar. It was just like that, what I'm telling you. So he says, when I tell you, when I give you the sign, you cry. You understand? He says, you'll see me, I'll give you the sign, and you start to cry. He said, Benny, you got to do this. That's exactly his words, right? So we get to the dean, and she goes over my transcript. She says, you know, I don't know whether you can make it or not here. You know, you have a D here in genetics. Well, I had gotten that D because I if you cut this man's class, I had an A in genetics, really, and my grade was reduced to a D because he took off one grade point per cut that you made beyond the cuts that he gave you. You could only cut his cast three times, and I cut six times. And I gave him a D. So she said, and that's important for medicine, to genetics. And I said, well, yes, ma'am, but I you know, I really want to go to school here, and I'll, you know, I made a mistake. I cut the class. She didn't understand all of that, mm-hmm. you know, that when the kind of the rules. But to make a long story short, my friend gave me the sign, and I said, I got to go. I don't know any other way. And I heard later on that this lady, Mademoiselle Grosslin was her name, G-R-O-S-S-E-L-I-N, had dated a Moor, and it was very partial to what is going on in the United States and the prejudices against blacks and so forth. And so she was very sympathetic. Very lovely woman, big woman, very sympathetic and to our cause. And so she saw me tearing, and she said, well, you have a good background. You were a soldier. You were a paratrooper. I said, yes, ma'am. And she says, we're going to admit you. And she says, I don't know how you're going to make it, but I think you'll make it. You know, I walked out of there. I was the happiest guy in the world. Went back to Heidelberg. I had an old car. Packed that car with my belongings and came to Geneva. Mm-hmm. Started to, and then got a room in Geneva. Then went back to Paris. Got on the boat train. Went back down to. And came to get my wife.
Mm-hmm. So she spent a few years there.
Yes, she did. She spent 2 years there. My oldest daughter was born there, mm-hmm. and so forth. So then I came. She came, and we had an apartment and everything, just like I dreamed of. And she enrolled in the school of music, and she was getting her master's in music. She was a music major. She had finished Fisk. As a music major, and was getting a master's, and she didn't know French, but she had French in high school. So we went to the, very interesting, when you go to the University of Geneva and you're a foreign student, you don't know French, they assign you to a French class. You have to go and you have to take this test to see where you fit in to what level of the French class. So she had French, and but anyway, they said to her, and me both. You have had, but still you'll take this little test. So they dictate to you a paragraph or two and you have to write it. And then they grade that, and then according to what you get, they place you in beginning or right on up the line in terms of what class of French you should be. So anyway, even though she had had French, I got placed in the beginner's class. In the beginner's class, you go there, and it's very interesting. They have maybe 30 or 40 new students in different faculties, faculty de medicine, faculty de loi, different, but you're all beginning to learn this. And so you have a textbook and so forth. But anyway, they would give all of us an assignment. But when I would go home that night and read the assignment, I would memorize it, whatever it was. And because when you go back to class, she would go from student to student, and you would read the next or do the next paragraph or whatever. So when she would get to me, she would say, "Monsieur Prim," and I was supposed to go. I mean, I wouldn't have to look at the book. I would just go blah, 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 blah. One day she looked at me, and I thought I had done something wrong, She said, "Monsieur, après l'or, je vous, I want to see you." And I said, "What did I do wrong?" And then, because this, my whole career counted on me knowing French. So anyway, I got to her, went up to her. My wife was in the class. She says, "I don't want you to come back anymore." And you can imagine, I'm 26 years old and got my wife there, and this is, I'm put all my eggs in this one basket. She don't want me to come back to the class anymore. How am I going to learn French? She says, "You're going to be okay." She says, "I want you to do something," she said. And then she kind of leaned forward to give me some confidence. She says, "I want you to speak to everybody you can, anytime you can have an opportunity. I want you to go to class every day," she said. "And don't be afraid and don't be ashamed if you don't have the right verb or whatever. You're going to be okay," she says. "And you'll see," she says, "you'll see." She says, "Don't be discouraged, but you don't need to come. You don't need to come here." My wife was furious. She had to continue, right? So anyway, I did that. And 6 or 7 months later, I was taking notes, half in English, half in French. But that's the way it happened. Mm-hmm. And I never studied a word of formal French except for that. About a week and a half in that woman's class.
Yeah. Now, in the med school curriculum, did you have...
It was all French.
So it was all French. And was it? Was there anything at all on narcotics addiction?
No.
Or anything of that kind? And you became an anesthesiologist?
Yes.
There?
No.
You returned for your residency?
I came back to the United States. I did an internship at Meadowbrook Hospital on Long Island, which is now Nassau County General Hospital. I was the first resident that they ever had in anesthesia. I was the first anesthesia resident, and I won the internship of the year award, became the first resident in anesthesia, finished my anesthesiology, and passed my board, and passed my New York State board 1 year after I started my internship. When that's over, I took my board as soon as I was eligible, because I had to make some money because I had a kid.
Mm-hmm. And why anesthesiology?
Well, let me tell you. In 1960, when I started my residency of January 60, because I finished in December 59 from Geneva, I wanted to do OBGYN. To get an OBGYN residency, it was very, very difficult, and extremely difficult for a foreign medical graduate and a foreign medical graduate who happened to be black, right? Mm-hmm. You could go to Harlem Hospital, or you could go to Lincoln Hospital, maybe, if you could get in, but the competition was very keen. And you got to remember, when I finished medical school, in 1959, December, which ended in January, the next month, right? First of all, when I wanted to apply to medical school in 1950, because this is real history for you, there were 5,000 applicants, black applicants, to medical schools in 1950.
In the entire country?
In the entire states. No admission to medical schools of blacks below the Mason-Dixon line to white medical schools. None. Two medical schools accepted blacks, and that was Howard and Meharry. And they accepted about 180. And then around the country, there were schools like NYU that accept two, Harvard maybe three, University of Michigan four. So when I graduated from medical school that year, there were only about 227 African Americans that graduated from medical school.
Sounds like you're quite a historian yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I went through all this. I lived it, right?
Yeah.
And so a residency for a black guy was almost impossible if you hadn't gone to one of these schools. So the first they took were guys who went to Harvard or NYU or whatever, or Michigan. A couple went to California. A couple may have gotten into Loma Linda University, but nothing below the Mason-Dixon line. As a matter of fact, remember I mentioned the two guys who were at Geneva, mm-hmm. who was juniors. Well, both of them, one was from New Jersey and one was from Louisiana. The state of Louisiana paid his way to medical school because he was getting ready to apply to medical school at the University of Louisiana, and they didn't want that blacks to do that. So they paid his way at Geneva so that he wouldn't. That's how bad racism was. When I tell you, was rampant.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chuck Wilson was from New Jersey. Of course, he was on the GI Bill like I was on the GI Bill at Geneva. Mm-hmm. But I giving you that background mm-hmm. because that's the way it was. So people ask you, why did you go over there to medical school? Are you crazy? Medicine's hard. Plus, you said this in a different language, and you had to learn, but that was the way I had to make it.
Right.
I had no other way of getting to my goal. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to be a doctor from the time I was a little boy. And I played it with my father was a film director, my mother was a teacher, school principal. And I played as with my brother. He would play as the film director, and I would play as the doctor. We had a small little city where we built, and we'd have accidents, and I'd say people got killed. And
he'd come in.
Yeah, and he'd come in, and he would bury them. We did that. That's what we did.
Yeah.
And so he became a film director, and I became the doctor. I mean, just like that. That's the way it was.
So did you find anesthesiology interesting when you encountered it at first?
Well, actually, not really. I thought, this was a new residency. I would be able to get admitted to this residency, and it wouldn't be a lot of fanfare. Rather than to try to go OBGYN, because I knew how racist it was, and they just didn't want you black guys really doing physical exams on white women. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just that bad. Because the first year when I finished my residency, I took my exam for the state boards, and I passed the first time. And so I got my license. So I was one of the few guys that were licensed in my intern class. Mm-hmm. So then I could go and work in another hospital with this license, because we were only making, that time, about $3,600 a year, $300 a month, mm-hmm. right? And so what I did was I got my license and I went to work in different hospitals. I went to Good Samaritan Hospital in West Islip, and I made $3 an hour, and I left. I worked 36 hours on and 12 hours off mm-hmm. at my internship and residency. The 12 hours I had off, I would go and work in the other hospital for those 12 hours. And it would make me $36. That's a lot of money, then, right? I saved up enough to buy a house for my wife and kids, you know. And I did that, and, you know, it was just wonderful. Then I knew, too, my experience there was, I remember a Good Samaritan. This woman came in, and she had an acute abdomen. I covered the emergency room. And I palpated her, and I knew right away, because during my internship, I had learned about ruptured ectopic pregnancies and all that. And so I went into the ER. She had a little vaginal bleeding, a little spotting, but she had an acute abdomen. And so I said, you know, she's going to have to be examined. And the nurse called me out because she had said something to the nurse. And she said, "That nigga, I don't want that nigga to touch me." And I said that too. So I said, "Okay." I said, "I tell you what, she's going to die. She's got a ruptured ectopic pregnancy." So I said, "I'm going to go back to the quarters and sleep." And I said, "You let her know that if she isn't seen soon, she's gonna bleed to death. She's bleeding internally, so she's going to die." Anyway, she changed her mind. But that's the kind of thing you ran into.
Wow.
And that's the kind of thing I ran into when I became a resident in anesthesia. I mean, when people would be going for operations, I'd go do the pre-op. And they said, "I don't want that nigga to put me to sleep." I mean, that was just that kind of prejudice on Long Island where I did my residency. Things were not good.
How did you handle that? How did you cope with that?
Well, you know, I had been in the service, and I had been encountered prejudice all the time. I mean, when I went to jump school, when I went to the 82nd, there were the black showers for blacks and officers and white officers. I mean, you know, you couldn't go in the restaurants. This was 1950. 1950, 51, 52, 53. So, you know, the civil rights movement hadn't started.
Yeah.
You know, all that hadn't gone on. So racism was the order of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I knew. I mean, there were whites that embraced me. I mean, you know, but there were always whites that just hated black folk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and we knew that. So you had to be schizophrenic in a way, because the only way I was going to get where I had to go was to be with white folks and learning, you know, in terms of my residency in anesthesia and learning medicine. That's who controlled the hospital. So,
right.
I mean, I did the best I could. I coped with it. I mean, I had some bitterness, and I'd get over that anger very quickly because you had to do your work.
Mm-hmm. So at what point did you start working in Harlem?
In 1963, 3 years after I finished my residency.
And what drew you there? I mean,
well, because the only... I'll give you an idea. There's a guy from Finland named Blair Wachter who was my junior resident in anesthesia. I taught him to do anesthesia, how to do it, right? Blair had come here from Finland, was married, was a heavy, heavy drinker, vodka drinker, and had three children. Even went on welfare while he was on, because he had three children, and he qualified for welfare, even though he was on salary as a resident in anesthesia. And before he graduated, because he came the second year. I was the senior resident when he was a junior. And when he was anticipated, he's a graduate, he got a job at North Shore General Hospital, which was in Nassau County. They needed an anesthesiologist, and I knew that. Paying $30,000 a year, the top guy in my class and trained him and Dr. Lutzberg, who was the woman who came afterwards, they both got jobs, got placed, but I couldn't because I was black. Mm-hmm. And the way I could get a job was at Harlem Hospital, where the chief of anesthesia there was a black guy, Herbie Cave, and everybody knew about me, and I went there and was making $13,000 a year.
Wow.
I was very bitter about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then later on, I became chief of anesthesia at Oyster Bay Hospital, which was an all-white hospital, and I was chief there because people in Nassau County knew of this black guy who was an anesthesiologist who was so good at Nassau General, because many of the doctors who were attendings at Nassau General Hospital were from Oyster Bay, was from North Shore, or other places that there. So they would be surgeons,
right,
and you know, working as attending physicians. And I was, when I was a resident, I put their patients to sleep, you know, because this was the public hospital in Nassau County. So they knew how good I was.
Yeah. So did you at that point? Did you, Henry Beecher at Mass General? At that point, is
sure. I knew Beecher.
Was releasing. I mean, he was criticizing the field for anesthesia-related mortality. Would you have known that about that at that time? Would that be something that you would remember?
No. Tell me about it, because it may jog my memory.
Have written about Beecher.
Beecher was a renowned anesthesiologist.
And and he was, as you know, a bit of a whistleblower later in terms of informed consent and all that sort of thing. But in the 50s, he was a whistleblower among his colleagues in anesthesiology because he was concerned about excess mortality rates, anesthesia-related mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote a few articles, and there was massive outcry from the field, criticism of Beecher for doing this. And so I wondered if that kind of would have reached you, because you were sort of, you know, he was at that point doing research.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a very different world.
He was at the place where anesthesia was pioneered at Mass General. That's how I know him from the history.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah,
I met him at conferences.
Did you meet him at drug-related conferences? CPDD or CDAN? The forerunner of CDAN?
I'm not sure. I don't know how I know, but I knew Beecher.
Huh.
How I know him, I
well,
don't
Well, if you remember, let me know, even if it's out of the flow.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1963, you go to Harlem Hospital.
Yeah.
And is that at that point your only job?
That was my only job.
You're no longer working at all these different places at that point.
No, that was only at Harlem Hospital. Plus, I did do some moonlighting, and I worked in a doctor's office in Wyandanch, New York, as a general practitioner's office, and I did some house calls and covered him on the weekends. So made the extra money to pay for the house.
Yeah, right. So at what point do you begin to get interested in drug addiction?
At Harlem Hospital.
And so can you tell me, and up to that point, had you ever known anyone who had a drug or alcohol problem?
Well, you shied away from dealing with people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, an addict was the scum of the earth.
So you didn't have any. There's nobody in your family. There was
no
prior experience.
No.
So it's at Harlem. And so how do you realize? How do you begin to realize the
well,
extent of the
problem? Well, my job, because I handled emergency cases very well. So they put me on the shift from 4 o'clock on Friday, or 3 o'clock on Friday, to Sunday morning. So I was there during the weekend period, and that was my whole week's work. And I was off the rest of the week, so I could do whatever I wanted to, right? And so lots of emergency surgery came during my time there. And all the time the emergency surgery would come, it was generally either indirectly or directly associated with substance abuse. And so I had one night this kid who had exsanguinated almost bled to death from a gunshot wound of the heart. And we rushed him to the OR and opened his chest, and I could see he had another scar on his chest. And I said, you know, he was just semi-conscious, and he had been in the hospital here a year before with a stab wound in the heart. But he was an addict and was associated with addiction. So once I got his old chart and I read this, and then I wrote this paper that, well, actually I did a study, and I saw that 90% of the emergency surgery done at Harlem Hospital on the weekends were either directly or indirectly associated with narcotic addiction.
Was that your first paper?
Yeah, my first, and that went, the dean up at Columbia saw this paper that I wrote. Mel Yar was the dean at that time, who founded L-DOPA, by the way, big guy in Parkinson's disease. And he saw this and said, because there was an affiliation between Columbia and Harlem, and he saw the paper and he called me and said, you know, Dr. Prim, maybe you should do what you have suggested. And what I suggested was that if a person comes in the hospital and has a surgical or medical diagnosis, no matter what it was, and also happens to have a problem of substance abuse, that person should be seen and something done about it, the substance abuse, while they were more vulnerable and reachable in the hospital setting. And he thought that was a great idea, so he spoke to the chief of anesthesia at the hospital, Dr. K, because I was already had done some very innovative things at Harlem Hospital. The first time they had resuscitation team, I started it and trained the resuscitation team. They never had even a cart for code blue, you know, where you, when somebody has a failing heart, that you go to them, you know, and try to. They didn't have anything like that going. I started all that at Harlem. And so I was very innovative and known in the hospital and very friendly with the nurses and all that kind of stuff. And I would get the student nurses to help me do all kinds of things, you know. So anyway, I said I should do this thing and have a team of people that go in and see somebody who may have a surgical diagnosis or a medical diagnosis or whatever the diagnosis was and had a substance abuse problem and talk to them about going into to drug treatment and getting them into drug treatment. And so
what was drug treatment? What did
It wasn't much of anything. It was mostly therapeutic communities. Mm-hmm. And I call this thing HOC, the Hospital Orientation Center. So how I did it was...
Did you know about methadone then?
Yeah, I knew something about it. I'll tell you about that. The HOC, the Hospital Orientation Center, had a staff of three people. As a matter of fact, me and a secretary and another young fellow that I got to work with me. We worked out of a closet, literally. That was my office. We set it up. And we started seeing people, you know, and not having any place for people to go, as a matter of fact, to get treatment. I mean, if you were in the TC, therapeutic communities were going, you know, Phoenix House was going at the time, just starting. Mm-hmm. That was Odyssey House. That was Exodus House. And that was the Addicts Rehabilitation Center. That was it in New York. And they had limited space. Mm-hmm. Methadone was just starting in 1965, 64, but it was at Beth Israel Hospital downtown. And there were only, you had to go, if you were in Harlem and you were addicted and you wanted treatment and you wanted to get on methadone, you had to go down to Beth Israel to be inducted. And then you would, you know, be inducted and stabilized, supposedly. Then you were sent up to Harlem where they would dispense the medication. So I was kind of a revolutionary, too. I said, why do black people have to leave Harlem, the center of addiction, where black doctors are here in great numbers, and we're all smart, just as good as white doctors, and send them downtown to a hospital where it's very difficult for me to even practice medicine, and put them on a substance that they're going to have to be on for the rest of their lives, supposedly, and then send them back uptown for us to continue to refill their drug need. I say, something's wrong with that, you know. I say, something's radically wrong. What are these white people doing, you know? Are they trying to enslave black folks and make us all zombies?
So you thought that at the time?
Yes, yes, I thought. And then, you know, I'm kind of a revolutionary anyway. And I said, what is this bullshit? You know, I don't want this anymore. And Dr. Trussell, who was the dean of the affiliation contract, they literally, you know, despised me because they thought I was going to ruin this whole thing that they had started that was going to save the world in terms of addiction. Mm-hmm. Anyway, about a year later, there was an institution that started up, and I was very known, well known then in New York, of being interested in the addiction problem, by a guy named Dr. Thomas Matthew. And Tom had started up a thing called NEGRO, the National Economic Growth and Reconstruction Organization. NEGRO was to do health care, develop economic endeavors for black folk, you know, this is to liberate us, mm-hmm. to liberate black, can you imagine? I mean, but Tom was a very prominent neurosurgeon, and I was known and very active and vocal anesthesiologist, and so he got me to come to work in the institution called Interfaith Hospital that he set up, really. And I was going to do the anesthesia there, and he would do surgery, and we also would do work about the addicted and bring addicts in and detoxify them and do therapy and so forth. And I had got this experience already at Harlem, where I had this hospital orientation center, so I was the guy who was in charge of the hospital. I was director of professional services. So I worked at Harlem, and I did that. This was in the middle 60s, you know, like 65, 66, 67. And then at the same time, Mayor Lindsay, I guess what, this was 68, I guess, Bobby Kennedy was killed, if you remember. He was going to run for president.
Yeah.
And when he was assassinated, Nick Katzenbach, who was the Attorney General, and Burke Marshall, that whole group of Democrats had come back to New York, and they needed a candidate for the presidency of the United States. And Lindsay was running for, want to switch from Republican to become a Democrat. And when Bobby was killed, was trying to position himself to become the Democratic candidate for the presidency of the United States. And the problem of addiction in New York City was rampant. He was the mayor. And one of the weak spots in his administration was he didn't know what to do about the addiction. And Beth Israel Hospital, which, you know, had this very closed methadone maintenance treatment program, was supposedly the answer at the time. And Lindsay, Dr. Prim. Hey, hi,
Holly. With Mayor Lindsay, and the difficulty that New York City and state were having at that point
exactly.
in figuring out what to do.
With New York City, primarily.
Yeah.
The only hospital that was treating addicts was closed up because of its poor performance. It was on North Brothers Island, was Riverside Hospital.
Yes, certainly.
And Dr. Trussell was chosen by the governor of New York, who was Tom Dewey at the time, to investigate the hospital.
So when did Riverside close?
Probably 1962 or 63, uh-huh. somewhere in that vicinity. And Dr. Trussell, who was at the Columbia School of Public Health, mm-hmm. Once he closed Riverside, knew of the work of Dolan Nyswander,
yeah.
and down at Rockefeller, and she was at the Marsh Bernstein Institute, which is the she was Manhattan General Hospital, where Ms. Niswander, Dr. Niswander was. And so anyway, he knew that this work was being done, and so he wanted to do something because he had become commissioner after he headed up this committee to investigate Riverside, found that it was a total failure and should be closed, and recommended to Dewey that it should be, and it was closed. He knew something else had to be done. Then he became commissioner of health in the city of New York, Trussell did. And then he got Dole and Niswander to a $100,000 grant from a research company in New York. I forget the name of it now. Not company, but a research
a
sort
foundation.
Of a found foundation.
Yeah, I remember. Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence of that, allowed them to continue their work with methadone maintenance at Beth Israel, Manhattan General, which now became the Marsh Bernstein Institute. They did and developed this, and then they expanded the program, and it got expanded even to Harlem Hospital, where there was a fellow that they trained named James Robertson, an MD, and he ran the Harlem, he was an internist, general practitioner, sort of ran the Harlem methadone maintenance treatment program. And they would send patients who were inducted at the Morris Bernstein Institute or Manhattan General after they inducted them and kept down there for a couple of weeks or so and stabilized them with methadone up to Harlem, and they were medicated at Harlem. And that bothered doctors at Harlem too. What is this bullshit? You know, we have to go downtown, do this, do that, whatever. And then, you know, the whole Tuskegee thing was out about that time too, and experimented on black people, and then racism was still rampant. And, you know, we had all kinds of cockamamie ideas about what was going on. Plus, it was so racist that there were very few, if any, doctors on the staff of Beth Israel, and, you know, or very few black doctors on the staff of any white hospital in New York. And I'm talking about Cornell, you know, New York Hospital, Presbyterian had maybe four or five, you know, that was it. You know, they just didn't exist. Yeah. So it was all, you know, we were all suspect of things, you know.
Yes.
Let alone being shut out, you know, which further exacerbated our feelings of distrust and racism toward us, you know. These were real issues. I mean, you can imagine if you put yourself in the position that you've done all this studying. I mean, I passed my exams, 1, 2, 3, and it's white boys who had gone to American schools, took the exam with me, who didn't pass the first time. And, you know, I have to, if they failed and they passed the next time the New York State Board, they could get reciprocity to go to another state to practice. I had to go to that other state and take an exam just as a foreign grad, even though I passed the first time with a high mark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was very angry. Had been a paratrooper, had been a, you know, an all,
yes,
kind of Johnny Armstrong, all-American boy, you know, doing everything right, and, you know. But,
So, at some point, you translate that anger and that revolutionary spirit into starting your own institution.
Exactly. So what happened?
Tell
Let me tell you what happened there. The Vera Institute of Justice, which was headed up
sure.
at that time by Herb Sturz, you know the Vera Institute?
I knew it.
Okay. was very close to Lindsay, and Herb was sort of a back room negotiator when it came to politics. Burke Marshall was at the Ford Foundation. Nick Katzenbach was vice president of IBM. They were all Kennedy people who needed this to bolster this candidacy of John Lindsay and to shore him up in terms of his approach to do something about the addiction problem in the city that was suffering from addiction. So they knew of the success of the methadone program, and so there was no methadone program in Brooklyn, where the problem was up and going, and still none really established in Harlem except that Harlem Hospital program where it was hard to get on it and so forth. And then there was one in the Bronx already with Joyce Lawrenson with Albert Einstein College of Medicine. But really where the center of addiction was Harlem, and you know, there's nothing, and Lindsay's the mayor, so they said, look, what we need to do is to start some drug treatment programs in Brooklyn and in Harlem. And so they used the Model Cities Initiative money and their contact with Bert Brown, who was then at the National Institute of Mental Health, and got some money through that, and spoke to Lois Chatham, who worked at the National Institute of Mental Health, and to start a program in Brooklyn that would treat 5,000 addicts, 2,500 in Brooklyn, and expand and treat 2,500 a little later in Harlem, and made 5,000. And through the Model Cities program and a star-studded board of directors and the Vera Institute of Justice to come up with a way to get the money to do that. And so Lindsay would have a way to have taken care of his addiction problem in the city of New York. They needed somebody to go into the black communities and to explain the need for drug treatment programs, and to particularly explain the need that that maybe we should maybe expand methadone maintenance treatment, the Dolan Ice Wonder thing. Mm-hmm. Well, there was this guy up to Harlem Hospital named Benny Prim, who'd been very outspoken and had taken over some buildings in Harlem and took over some abandoned buildings and took over a state building, and by night smuggled in beds and sheets and medical equipment and set up a detoxification center right on 125th Street in Harlem. There was a way that I went underground through a garage and up into the building and took the building and set up detox right in this building, a whole hospital setting, unbeknownst to the people who owned the building, and it really belonged to the state, and you know, they didn't know what to do. I started treating addicts there the next day, detoxifying, because there was no program. So, you know, they knew that he was this active guy who the community might believe in, and so they asked me, would I consult to their program that they wanted to start? So I did.
But at that point, did you believe in methadone maintenance?
I thought methadone was good, but you could be methadone to absence. I didn't think you had to be methadone ad infinitum, mm-hmm. to stay on mm-hmm. it for the rest of your life. I thought you could use it as a tool to get people into treatment, start doing, you know, psychotherapy, whatever else you needed, and you know, provide services for them that would then turn them around, and they would not necessarily be doing the criminal behavior and all that stuff. So I got chosen as a consultant to this program to go out and talk to residents in Brooklyn and so forth. And I did. And so when the program was getting ready to get started, they needed somebody to direct the program. And I was working at Interfaith, running that detox center there at Interfaith and doing all kind of revolutionary stuff in Harlem and wherever. And so I knew the street people. Mm-hmm. I was dealing with them. A lot of them were addicts, you know. And I had taken over offices downtown New York, social service offices, and I'd become known as a guy who was responsible, not violent, you know, and not really that kind of revolutionary type, but outspoken and really telling the truth primarily, because it's a woman I never got put in jail or got beat up by the cops. It was amazing how I was treated, really. To make a long story short, I then, after consulting with this program and talked about the need in Brooklyn, and the people in Brooklyn finally said, well, you can establish it in the Model Cities area, and they got the building and whatnot. They said, well, Benny, what about you running the program? I said, you kidding me? I didn't run no methadone program. Why would I want to run a methadone? People on stuff for the rest of their lives. I mean, I was just that dismissive of it, you know. Mm-hmm. He said, well, you know, you can run it like you want. I mean, but why don't you, you'll have, this will be good research for you. You'll have Harvard that will do the legal part to see the impact that the company, you know, your program will make on the criminal activity of these people. You'll have Yale, they'll do the medical evaluation, and Herb Cleaver will do that. Jim Vornberg will be from Harvard doing the criminal, and Lukoff at Columbia will do the social, and you'll have three evaluations there, and it's beginning to look pretty good.
So this
me.
Is
68. I said, no, I don't want that. They said, listen, why don't you give it a thought? I said, no, I don't want that. I'm doing what I'm doing, and you guys, you all go ahead with that. So they came back to me, kept coming back to me. They said, what would you take to do this? I said, I don't want anything. I don't want to do it. They said, well, we'll pay you what you're making now and more, and you don't have to be going to all these different hospitals doing anesthesia and hustling here and there. You can direct your mind to doing some just research and whatever. Dr. Prim. Yes, sweetheart. I'm still in the interview. Okay. I'll call you right back. I'll call you back when I finish. Okay. And they said, well, we'll offer you $40,000 a year. So I was, you know, in my anesthesia practice, after I paid all my nurse anesthetists, I was clearing about 28 maybe. I said, that sounds pretty good. No call, pay my malpractice insurance, and I don't have to worry with these people that in anesthesia were. I was at chief of anesthesia at Whitestone Hospital. First year I was there, they took 10% of whatever I made. Next year, 15%. That year, they were going to take 20% of whatever my gross was. I said, what am I doing here? I mean, these guys are just taking my money for me to be here at the hospital doing work that they need to get done. I said, well, this is ridiculous. It was a ripoff, you know? So then Herb says, Benny, look, you got to do this. And he says, we'll pay you $45,000 a year and all your expenses and everything else, and if you run this program, because we think you're the guy. I said, okay, so I don't want any, okay, I'll do it. I'll take the medical. I don't want any bullshit with the administration. And they said, no, just be cool. You'll be all right. So anyway, I had a guy, a lawyer, to do the administrative part, and that's the story. We opened
it
up.
That's how ARTC.
That's how ARTC got started.
I was going to ask you where you got the money for that.
And it was $1.4 million or something like that. And it was through the Vere Institute of Justice in the city of New York, model cities. That's how the money flowed. Mm-hmm. And then I was in the papers. It was said that I was. That ARTC, the whole idea, this is what Dr. Dole said, was the ARTC thing was a 10-ton airplane with a 1-horsepower motor, and I was the 1-horsepower motor, and it will never fly.
And why was Dole so skeptical?
Because they knew that I had been not a proponent of classical methadone maintenance, but I started talking about neoclassical methadone maintenance and ways to do it, methadone to abstinence and so forth. In other words, there were variations on the theme as far as I was concerned. I mean, there's no set way to do anything, you know, but they were unalterably opposed to this new thing that they had going, and they rightfully so. They had put a lot of research and time into this, and I could understand that. And they,
right,
they
was
just,
religious fervor.
Oh yes,
their
yes.
Ideology.
Oh yes, yeah. friend Gehring was up at Columbia, and Trussell, who was then now the Commissioner of Health of the City of New York, and he was backing them, and this guy Prim was up there making these problems for us, and you know, and now he's going to start this program in Brooklyn. There were some scathing articles about me in the New York. If you want, I can share all this stuff with you. These are New York Times stuff.
You've kept this.
Yes. Yeah,
I'd like to see what you've done.
You would freak out.
Yeah.
And they said I was killing people, and I was giving children methadone, and that I was manipulating the doses, and people were dying from overdoses. All this was in the paper. Mm-hmm. Sure. They were tarring and feathering me, you know.
Yeah.
But.
And how did you handle that? How did you respond to that?
I said, these people are just...
Because you were convinced.
These are mean white people, I would say, you know. These are the devil, you know.
So
not nice people.
So you get that program up and going pretty quickly, though.
Yeah, in October of 1969.
And then are you basically just running that program?
Yes.
Until Jaffe gets interested in it, or how does
Jaffe
next?
No, let me tell you what happened. See, I mean, as a doctor, as an anesthesiologist, I always said, look, you know, you got to know the science behind this stuff. I said, doctors can't be going out here running a methadone program, and they won't let me come over to Beth Israel to learn what they did. They won't share their information with me, right? I said, I got to find a way to learn about this from a medical scientific point of view. So I make an arrangement to go to the Addiction Research Center.
You mean
ARC.
In Lexington?
In Lexington. I go down to Lexington and spend 2 weeks.
When?
1968. So I'm down there with Don
Kaczynski. They don't like methadone at the ARC. They don't like methadone maintenance.
What do you mean they don't
like
it?
At the ARC.
No, they were teaching. They were the people who were doing the initial studies.
Yes.
They did the initial stuff on
right,
methadone.
But
Frank Frazier.
But they did not like maintenance. They did not like at all.
That's true. So, but they allowed me to come. And probably they allowed me to come because they had heard these things about me in New York.
Yeah, I bet.
And so that was okay with me. So let me go and learn from these white boys at the World Research Center how to really do this thing. And plus, you know, they're not in favor of maintenance or whatever,
right.
But they want to use it in whatever way they want to use it. So I went there, spent 2 weeks. And Don Jasinski and Chuck Gorodetsky, these guys were just Frank Frazier and
Bill Martin. There then.
Yeah, sure. They all said, okay, come on in. We'll teach you a little something. And I went down there. They were very nice to me.
So what did you make of that place?
I thought it was wonderful. I thought it was, you know.
Had you heard of it before?
Yeah, sure. But, you know, it was, you know, there's addicts over there.
Yeah,
there in Fort Worth, listen to women.
I just wrote a book about the ARC.
You did?
Yeah,
sure.
From the beginning to mostly post-World War II.
Mm-hmm. This was a very select group of guys, you know. Dr. Prim. Hey, sweetheart, how are you? I got your message. Where are you, in Atlanta? Mm-hmm. You're waiting to get India or whatever? Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm doing an interview, a historical interview. Can I call you back as soon as I get out of here? I'll call you back, sweetheart. Okay. Bye bye. It's my oldest daughter. Mm. She's a psychiatrist. She's now the deputy medical director of the American Psychiatric Association. Hmm. She is the in charge of all minority mental health.
This is
Annell.
Annell, mm-hmm. Yes.
You know of her.
Well, when I was searching for you, for your publications, some of her stuff came up.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, where were we?
Oh, we were in Lexington.
Okay.
One of my favorite places.
So tell me what your impressions were. I lived there in a hotel and went over there every day. And it was just like I was going to work. And mm-hmm. Talked to patients and the prisoners. And about methadone, learned to see how it worked once when you gave it, and all that. Mm-hmm. And Chuck Gardesky really took a liking to me, and Don Jasinski, they thought I was, you know, this crazy black kid guy from New York who they were very, you know, admiring of my spunk, my whatever, yeah. You know, and we all became very good friends. Mm-hmm. You know, we're very, very good friends now. You know. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, I've talked to all of them at length and learned a lot from them.
Yeah. So then I heard about Jaffe was out there in Chicago running a program. He had been up at Einstein and did his residency, and then he was out here with the Illinois Drug Abuse Program. Mm-hmm. And I thought that substance abuse should have all these modalities. Why should we just have this methadone maintenance and people, you know, ad infinitum all their lives? Mm-hmm. We could have methadone maintenance and switch them over to, they could go into a TC once they detoxed, and maybe they'd be end up being drug free and so forth. And they had this, you know, I heard about this guy out there. And so I said, well, why not? I'll go out and see him. I called him up. I went out there, and, you know, Jerry kind of looked at me. What do you want to know this for? You know, he was just very frank. What do you know, he didn't know what I was. Where I was
oh, so you found him.
Yeah.
I thought he found you. So.
And we became very, very close, right? I stayed out there about 2 weeks, and he had Safari House, and he had another place in a hospital where he was doing detox, and he was doing TC and switching people from methadone maintenance to drug-free and so forth, and they were doing exceptionally well, you know. And I really admired him. And he and Ed Sine taught me, you know, some more about maintenance and the mixing of the modalities, you know. So, and I go back to New York, and I said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm gonna do like Jerry Jaffe did in Chicago. And
so they must have been... I mean, how did they think about race at that point? Because they're obviously dealing with a whole bunch of black people.
Who is this, Jerry?
Yeah. I mean,
well,
I
Matt Wright, who
too.
Was Jerry's right-hand guy, was an ex-addict, and he ran Safari House. Mm-hmm. Then there was Joy Joya and David Deitch that were out mm-hmm. there with him. And see who else black. That was it for black guys.
It's pretty unusual for them to get someone like you, who's you're a clinician, but you're beginning, at that point you're not doing research, or you are?
No, I'm not doing research.
Yeah.
No. I didn't start ARTC yet.
So right.
I went out there just at the beginning and just before I went into ARTC.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
So you were looking for models.
Yes, looking for models and looking for something to duplicate. I mean, I hadn't been working in addiction. These guys have been working in addiction with addicts. What do I know about addicts except for they're on the operating table or that little thing that I ran at Interfaith Hospital, which was, you know, bringing them in, detoxifying them, and keeping them for 2 weeks and letting them go through therapy and so forth. And it was like a revolving door because, you know, I did it for about 2 years or so before I went over to... ARTC. That was in 66, 67, and 68. Then 69, I started ARTC.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1970, 71, I was at a conference in Washington. And I'm in the back of the room because I want to slip out, you know. And I wasn't gonna just stay. And some guy comes in the back of the room and says, you know, Dr. Jaffe is looking for you. It was a Secret Service guy. Scared me, you know. And he wants to see you. So I said, oh, sure. So I saw Jerry. He says, I want you to go to Vietnam with me.
I thought you were on that trip.
He said, we're going to go over there. President wants me to look at the drug problem, and I'd like you to go with me. I said, I can't do that. Are you kidding me? Go to Nam? I said, look, I'm a retired Army officer, Jerry. I don't want, you know, I've missed combat. I don't want to get killed. He said, "You're not going to get killed. Talk to me and how we're going to do." So I said, "Okay." I came home. I told my wife. She says, "Benny, you're crazy with this drug stuff. Please don't do this." I said, "Well, I think I have to do it, you know." And so she says, "Well, if you have to, I mean, you know, I don't want you to do it. We got kids. You know, you've done your army time, and now you're working with these addicts, too." She says, "You know, I'm afraid, you know." I said, "Well, don't be. I think I'm going to be all right." So they said, they brought me to Washington and said, "What we'll do, you come to Washington, we'll orient you, we'll get you some orientation and about the whole trip." And said, "You need to bring your wife, let your wife come down, be with you." So they brought her down to Washington, and the week before we went, and then we had to go, you know, make the trip. And he chose who was going to be on the trip. Seth, and what's the boy? The boy that went with Trish Mission, I'm trying to think of her name. Seth Rosenberg was Jerry's assistant, and then Donald something. I'll think of the name in a minute. I'm trying to think who was the domestic policy counsel. And this guy was Donfeld.
Oh, Donfeld.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jerry Donfeld.
Yeah, Jeffrey
Donfeld. And Seth Rosenberg was who accompanied us, and me and Jerry and a couple of bodyguards on the plane. And we took the first free radical assay testing machine mm-hmm. from Siva over there with us on the plane. So the plane left Dulles, and it was a very private 747, and my wife was to be on the plane with us, and we're going to drop her off in New York, you know, on the tarmac. This is what happened, right? And I don't know what Faith was. She wasn't on that plane, though. But anyway, Jerry and I, you know, we got on, and my wife was on the plane, flew her, and I guess the president said, "Well, stop in New York and let her off," and they took her home, and we kept on to Alaska. Stopped in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Alaska, and checked people coming back, their belongings, and had dogs sniff out drugs and their belongings in Anchorage. And we knew what we were going to be facing when we got over there, because people were shipping drugs back home and their belongings, you know, marijuana, whatever. And we flew from there to Taiwan, from there to Hong Kong, and from Hong Kong to Saigon. And we did the whole thing in Vietnam, and set up drug testing. Call it the pee house of the Harvest Moon. We had troughs where guys would come in and pee and wait to observe them and tested their urines. And if they were positive, up to the rank of major, if they were positive, we kept them, you know. And
So what did? How long were you there in Vietnam?
About 3 weeks.
And so what you actually did there was to set up this testing program?
Testing and go visit and set up treatment places in Vietnam at the front lines, too. Mm-hmm. I remember once we were in a plane, me, General Bernstein, and Jerry, and they started vomiting and they got sick because I didn't, you know, the plane motor, when the motors went out, we were on the over enemy territory. Thought we were going to crash. And I said, "Here I am in this damn place." And it didn't even have a chute, you know. I mean, I'm looking for a chute.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I said, "Well, what am I doing here?" You know, I had my friends who were, you know, colonels and of things who were over there in combat, who were in the 82nd with me, you know. Okay. Anyway, we flew up to the front, and they got sick, and Jerry had to go to the hospital, so he was in the hospital for about 10 days, so I had to run the whole thing by myself. And so we became very, very close. Yeah. And I had to talk to the generals and all that stuff, you know, and command them. I had the rank of a major general in order to command them, you know, to do, I mean, just a honorific rank so that I would be able to get things done, you know. It was nice. Then when we left Vietnam, they asked me, what would I like? I said, I'd like a couple of my friends to meet me in Hawaii. And guys who were in combat. You know, they sent two of my friends who were classmates, they were colonels, and met me at General Nimitz, Admiral Nimitz's house in Hawaii and for 4 days. And they had R&R, rec and recuperation, and the house was stocked with steaks and liquor and everything. It was just wonderful. They didn't know how they even got there. You know, I mean, the show, I really learned what power was in this country.
Right, right.
I mean, and you know, I mean, I was treated like a white boy. I put it like that. I mean, I
hate
better
to than
put,
most it, white boys.
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah. I mean, I began to, you know, I'm hobnobbing with the president. We came back. We met with San Clemente with the president. We're sitting around a table like this. And, you know, I mean, you know, from revolutionary Harlem taking over buildings, you know, black guy in Harlem, ex-paratrooper type, now sitting with the President of the United States telling him about substance abuse, you know. And he says, you guys got to write a book, and you know, I had a pipe in my hand, I smoked a pipe, and I think he got a little bit afraid because he didn't know what, he didn't recognize it was a pipe until I put it on the table, and he was more comfortable. But, it's pictures of all this, by the way. I have pictures of all this stuff.
You have pictures of it.
All this stuff.
Yeah. I'd like to come visit and see what you've got in your files.
You're going to be fascinated. You'll be fascinated.
Yeah. Incredible. So you have all that at ARTC?
Yeah.
At home?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'd love to come and see what you've got.
Then we, then after that, when we came back, Jerry, you know, he's the drug czar. So he said, Benny, I want you to continue to, you know, help me. I said, Jerry, I got to run my program. He says, you'll fix, you come, you fly down here, you can, you know, every day fly back to New York and just help set up the office and do whatever. And that's what I did.
So you still had your house and everything in
New York? Yeah, in New York. We would fly down in the morning, get up. Go down.
You actually did this.
Go get the 7 o'clock shuttle, or the 8 o'clock shuttle. Be in Washington at 9:00 at my desk at 9:15. In the old executive office building.
So how long did you do that?
About a year, year and a half.
Wow.
About 2-3 times a week.
And so, that's why you weren't really an employee.
Never.
You had this commuting
relationship. Exactly, yes. And that was the Special Action Office of Drug Abuse Prevention.
Right.
That was during that time.
Right.
And
so what did you do for them?
My wife down?
Huh? What did you do for them? I mean, what kinds of stuff did you do for...
Oh, let me tell you, that my first job was to train all the people who would, in the United States, at the Army facilities and the VA hospitals, mm-hmm. so that they would be able to accept the soldiers coming back from Vietnam and be able to treat them right. So I would go to all the posts. Then I chose a team that would go to these posts and train these people all mm-hmm. around the country. Mm-hmm. And I brought them into Washington, trained them. I have pictures of all these guys that I trained. And then we sent one team to Vietnam, and I have those, and you know.
I see. So you did the whole
that
return
was my
Vietnam
job.
Vets.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you haven't gotten to the CPDD yet because...
No, I was going to ask you when you first started to be involved with CPDD.
72. The reason I want that because it reminds me because Lee Robbins did the...
Yeah, I was going
to... Okay, and Lee and I were the first two minorities. She as a woman and me as a black, mm-hmm. on the committee on problem with drug dependence, right?
Yeah.
that's when Hans Kosowitz and Hughes, John Hughes, people like that, mm-hmm. Eric Simon, who were members, would come to this meeting. Mm-hmm. And we would criticize the committee for even funding Kosowitz, you know, he found in Keflin.
Yeah.
I mean, the what gets me is how this thing is involved, and I see these kids around here in shorts and t-shirts and whatnot.
It's got to be a little weird.
Yeah, but I mean, that's why at plenary, that's why you see me like this. I'll never change, you know.
Because it's strange for me as
but
a historian.
But it's okay. You're still doing the work.
You know, just looking at what CPDD was when it was CDAN, before it was CPDD,
mm-hmm.
and just noting, the organization has changed hugely.
Well, I only know it. She said 1929. It was 1927, as far as my concern today, this morning.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's interesting. It's the college's own problem of drug dependence. It's not just CPD, it's CPDD, and it was committee on problem of drug dependence. And that's really important because we're part of the National Academy of Science.
Yeah.
I mean, that was really, really important, you know, and what we did. I mean, there's a book. Did you read, is it Epstein who wrote the book about and was terribly critical of the CPDD?
Now, you're thinking of Steve Epstein in Pure Science? You mean Carolyn Acker?
No. This guy's Epstein.
Epstein. How critical of CPDD?
Oh, that we gave money to people out of this country.
Oh, that guy, Stephen J. Epstein, the journalist.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've read that.
I mean, we were terribly vilified. So I don't want to lose that history because that's important, building up to what's happened afterwards and what has happened now to enkephalins, endorphins, and has changed the whole in this whole brain science thing.
Yes.
All of that.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I think it's very important to get that history established.
Sure. So, you know.
Yeah, so CPDD, your first CPDD was 1972.
Mm-hmm. I made a speech. Methadone is no answer. I still have a speech. Now, and that, you know, it's not only methadone, you have to do something else with methadone. But I had come to that conclusion back then. And then when I became director of CSAT, well, I became director of OTI, you know, the Office of Treatment Improvement during the first Bush administration.
Right. So
they
wait
created
a second.
That place.
Now we're moving way too quickly for me. 1972, Sayodep transmutes into NIDA in 73. Are you involved with the early NIDA?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you're there for that whole sort of transition to DuPont?
Yes.
Okay.
But I didn't work on the DuPont at Sayodep. Okay. I mean,
right. Okay. So when Jaffe was gone, you were gone?
Yes.
Okay.
Even before Jaffe, but Jerry, I left maybe a year before Jaffe did.
Okay.
But I was still consulting and doing and whatever he would call me, you know, mm-hmm. and they had a special thing. And
mm-hmm. Okay. And then at what point do you return to, you worked under Ford as well, right? I mean,
no.
Oh, you didn't? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So at what point do you return to federal service? After Sayodep?
Well, I was on the NIDA Advisory Committee, and then on the Adamhaugh Advisory Committee.
And what were they doing at that time? What were those committees up to?
Oh, each department has an advisory committee. Mm-hmm. I was on the FDA advisory committee for a while that dealt with drugs and mm-hmm. drugs of abuse. And then I became a member of the NIDA advisory committee.
And do you think that was in the 70s? When you were on
Probably
NIDA?
In the 80s.
Okay. Were you around Sayodep NIDA at all when prisoner research became an issue?
When prisoner research?
Yeah, and then the ARC... Right, ends up having to move and all that.
No,
you weren't associated during that period of time.
No.
Okay, so it is going to be late the 80s?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And so what you're basically doing during that time is running ARTC.
That's right.
Okay. Now, what is URI?
The Urban Resource Institute is an offshoot. It was, I began to see all different social dislocations in the community that needed other attention, and I said, you can't get the grants to Addiction Research and Treatment Corporation, you know, that in New York State, they just didn't want to give you a grant to do battered women and other things, developmentally disabled stuff.
Mm-hmm.
With the name of addiction, mm-hmm. So I needed another corporation. So we set up a private profit corporation to do other stuff.
Yeah,
and
I
so
see.
There we do an alcoholism program. Mm-hmm. We do a developmental disabled program. We do AIDS education. Mm-hmm. We do transportation program for people who are developmentally disabled. And then we have intermediate care facilities for the severely disabled, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, and that you set up when?
83?
Okay, yeah, okay. All right. Okay. And then you return to Washington, though.
Yes.
Didn't you work for Carlton Turner?
Yes, I did. How did you know that?
Must have been some interview of you that I read that someone else had done.
Yeah, Carlton had me. I was a consultant to his office. But Carlton was the president's advisor on substance abuse. He was not, I think, what was his title?
Yeah, I don't remember, but it was kind of a...
Yeah, he was the drug czar.
Yeah, he was his own, but he was kind of his own phenomenon.
But the real drug czar, the first drug czar was Bennett. But Carlton had that kind of a role.
Yes, right.
And I used to consult with Carlton all the time.
And what sorts of things did you do then?
With Carlton, he constantly wanted my input in terms of policy and ways to go at the federal level, and wanted my presence because of my recognition in the black community,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he could make a way for him to be there and me at his side. He's more accepted.
Mm-hmm.
He used me, but I didn't mind being used.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got to be used in politics, but you use them too, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, that's
so
important to me.
How was he to work for?
He was good, because he was good. I mean, you know, he was he's a good Southern boy. I mean, and you know, Southern whites and blacks have a synergy. Though this racism, we know that. But you know, black women used to nurse their babies, and you know, I mean, that was the racism is there, but.
But there's also
Storm Thurman. You know, he had. I mean, he was having. Yeah. I mean, it was common. You know, so Carlton was a good Southern guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he didn't get much done, but you know, in terms of substance abuse.
And what would you say he was trying to do? I mean, what?
Well,
his status priorities?
Quo to keep things. Conservative, he pandered to that,
mm-hmm.
to the conservative side, and he was controlled by them, really.
Yeah, yeah.
He was safe. He was safe for that administration, you
mm-hmm.
know, and he did some good stuff, you know, but mostly nothing.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, but a nice guy.
Yeah.
Nice family guy.
Joe, hey, come on in. We have just heard about Carlton Turner, so that is where we are.
Okay.
This is Benny Prim, Dr. Prim.
Hi.
This is Joe Strain.
Joe, how are you doing?
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And
we'd had some fun. She just brought up stuff that made me laugh.
Well, so is he.
She has a tendency to do that, so yeah, that's good.
So you're here.
I am here. I'm going to let folks know what's going on, and then I'll come right back.
Hello. Hello.
Sorry, it's the whole crew.
Sure.
Okay. So,
you go right ahead, but I'll come in a bit. How
okay, long? I'm going to try to wind up so this poor man can get something to eat.
That's fair
and,
enough.
And I have, believe it or not, scheduled another interview at 1.
With
Ed...
Singleton.
Ed Singleton.
Okay.
So he'll be here at 1.
Oh, my.
So I'm going to... And I've got
to
eat
perhaps, you might want to get a bite to eat that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so I'm going to try to wind up in 10 minutes.
Then don't let me interrupt, but I'll...
Okay.
Yeah, that's all right. We'll talk afterwards.
Excellent. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, so let's try to... Because a lot of what comes later, I have some access to. I have a sense of what it is. I'd love to hear, it in the kind of detail that we've been doing, but maybe in the interest of time, we should try to compress and talk about your experience with CSAT. Does that make sense?
Well, let's talk about TI.
Yeah,
okay. The Office of Treatment Improvement was the SAMHSA. No,
yes.
It was ADAMHA, the Alcohol, Drug, and Health Administration.
Right, so it was still ADAMHA.
Yes.
And OTI, what the relationship between OTI and NIDA at that point is none, right? That's where the split between treatment and research kind of occurs.
Yeah, yes, kind of. There was the Office of Prevention. It wasn't the Office of Substance Abuse Prevention. It was, I forgot the acronym for the Prevention Office, and then there's the Office of Treatment Improvement.
Right.
OTI under ADAMHA. Then ADAMHA evolved into SAMHSA, and SAMHSA had the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, Center for Substance Abuse Prevention, and Center for Mental Health Services. I had problems with that break research and treatment. I did not want to get involved in a intra mural kind of war like that went on. I think there was some resentment on the part of NIDA that some of their funds were taken away to form OTI, and then when the NIMH moved from the ADAMHA over into NIH, there was this elitism that was created that these were drug abuse and that kind of mental health and that prevention was not really science, and science was everything that had to be under NIH, and NIMH was science, and so forth and so on.
Okay,
and
NIAAA. So let me clarify. You're saying that the elitism of NIDA was created by that.
It was always there,
split.
But it probably always felt something. But it was become more. It became more apparent during that period of time.
Yes. And so you didn't want to get involved in that.
No, I mean I could see us being together. I thought it would destroy substance abuse as we knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I still had influence at the NIDA thing because of my CPDD associations, mm-hmm. with the people who ran it, and I'm a member of the College of Neuropsychopharmacology.
Oh, you are?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so Goodwin and company, people like that, they liked me, and to tell you the truth, I think it helped to have a little color around for
yeah,
them too. I mean, even though certain areas I was not locked out, but I was not that privy to, but they were pretty accepting of me. And it allowed me to bring people, somebody else along who maybe are even more capable of me than I am in terms of their own preparation for the kind of research and stuff that goes on, which has been a godsend for the field. I mean, and I know that's sort of my role, and I know also that my role also is to get some things done politically and whatever. I mean, I'm very happy with what I've done in this field. You know, I think, I mean, you heard Jim Anthony this morning. I mean, you know, for Jim to pay that kind of tribute to this lonely guy who helped him along the way. I mean, because I saw a need for young, white or black, didn't matter to me, because my Army experience was such that if we got something going, I don't care what you are, that's for real. And I mean, and I see all my relationships like that. I mean, with Jerry Jaffe, it's like, you know, he's my brother. You know, they ain't no white boy or Jew. He's my brother. You know, his kids are like my kids. My kids are like his kids. You know, that's, they're all successful, all Harvard and all this, and they're just good kids. And I see Jim Anthony, he's like a son to me. You know what I mean?
And that was quite clear.
So.
And I think it's really interesting for a field like this that has to worry about how do we reproduce ourselves. You know, who's going to be coming into this field, and what are their, what's their approach going to be?
And I'm a champion of women involvement in this field. You know, I think, and you know, I look at Maxine Stitzer and you know, Loretta Finnegan and. And Cal Kottenbach and all of the women that I know, you know, that have done so much in this field, that and I champion their causes, you know.
So that OTI and the whole sort of break, that that moment, you experienced that as a rift. There was a
Plus, I was the first director of the Office of Treatment Improvement, and so. It was almost like I was part of the engineering of that to happen, even though that's what the president wanted me to do. So you got to remember that when when Daddy Bush was vice president, he asked me to put a team of people together to come down and talk to him about what he should do in substance abuse. Some of his people knew of my substance abuse work because I was on Reagan's Human Immunodeficiency Virus Epidemic Commission, the first AIDS commission. And I helped to write the chapter that was in the president's report on what to do with the addicted individuals and you know, from that commission. And so I got known by the people on that commission, and then I got recommended to the president to come and talk to him, and I chose six people to come with me to spend a couple of hours with him as vice president, and so that he would have his whole program shored up in terms of substance abuse. And so when he became president, he appointed me, or saw to it that the secretary appointed me to head up the Office of Treatment Improvement. No such office existed. I got a call to come to Washington because I was on the advisory committee to the NIMH, or really to Adam Ha, to Adam Ha's advisory committee. And I got a call from Dr. Weinberg to come and speak to let's see, who was it? Fred Goodwin, and Trachtenberg. They said, Benny, you're on the advisory committee, but we want you to do something else. The president wants you to do something else. So I said, I'm fine. I'm doing, you know, I just finished doing the thing with the president's advisory committee on the human immunodeficiency virus epidemic. I said, I just want to run my program now and just be cool. And they said, no, that's something that we want you to do. I said, what? They said, well, we want you to do what you have been advocating all along. In the meetings we can't, the advisory committees, we can't have a decent meeting because of you always suggesting this and suggesting that and suggesting the other, so we want you to do that. And I said, well, how? He said, well, there's this job. It's director of the Office of Treatment Improvement, and we want you to head it up and get it started. I said, no, I have to think about that. They said, look, you don't have any competition. This is the job. The president wants you to do this and that. We want you to do this, and that's that. I said, but you don't pay enough money for me. I'm just now getting... They said, do it. You don't have to come here to as an employee. We'll pay your company for you to be here. Hmm. I said, wow. And that's what they did. Hmm. So when Mr. Bush was getting elected and is having the Republican National Convention in New Orleans, they asked me to come and be on the boat with him coming down the Mississippi into New Orleans, and he's going to choose his vice president, Dan Quayle, that day. And I knew him, that I didn't know that it was going to be Dan Quayle, but I knew that's what's going to happen. So I went, got on the boat north of New Orleans in the Mississippi, and came down the river with him and then into New Orleans, and saw him, and he waved at me, talked to me, and I didn't see him anymore. I got appointed to this job, and you know, blah blah blah, the rest is history. Mm-hmm. And then the OTI became CSAP. Mm-hmm. And then I made the changes that I always wanted to make. About, I was able to talk about comprehensiveness, and that methadone should have this, and mm-hmm. drug abuse should have this, and that was implemented. And I'm just ecstatic about that. Mm-hmm. And it kind of revolutionized the drug treatment. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get representation from Native Americans, mm-hmm. and Hispanics, blacks involved in choosing grantees and all that, you know, on the different committees. And,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. So you actually got some participation, community participation in those committees.
Oh, yeah.
Well, would you like to wind up here?
Yeah, I think we should do some CPDD stuff we may have to do it again because you took me way back to my beginnings, you know.
How about we do this? I'll come to New York, and we can look through some of your stuff.
Sure.
And we can continue. We can really pick up with the CSAT sort of moment.
We'll do that. Sure.
So why don't I do that?
I think that the evolution of ARTC is just incredible too.
Yeah,
we're now about $50 million corporation.
Yeah, we haven't really done that either. So.
Still flying. I mean, we're a $50 million corporation and still growing. And there's been a building now built and named after me in New York. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
All right, so let's count on seeing each other again. And thank you very much for your time today, Father's Day.
Sure. So, Mrs. Campbell...